A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. You do know what I'm talking about, Arcos growled impatiently. Cherokee hesitated. Would you mind, Father Abbot, being specific, in case it's connected with something I might have heard about only in confession? Huh? Oh. Well, I'm bedeviled. You did hear his confession, I clean forgot. Well, get him to tell you again so you can talk, though heaven knows it's all over the Abbey anyhow. No, don't go see him now. I'll tell you, and don't answer on whatever's sealed. You've seen that stuff? Abbot Arcos waved toward his desk where the contents of Brother Francis's box had been emptied for examination. Cherokee nodded slowly. He dropped it beside the road when he fell. I helped gather it up, but I didn't look at it carefully. Well, you know what he claims it is? Father Cherokee glanced aside. He seemed not to hear the question. All right, all right, the abbot growled. Never mind what he claims it is. Just go look it over carefully yourself and decide what you think it is. Cherokee went to bend over the desk and scrutinize the papers carefully, one at a time, while the abbot paced and kept talking, seemingly to the priest, but half to himself. It's impossible. You did the right thing to send him back before he uncovered more. But of course that's not the worst part. The worst part is the old man he babbles about. It's getting too thick. I can't think of anything that could damage the case worse than a whole flood of improbable miracles. A few real incidents, certainly. It has to be established that the intercession of the Beatus has brought about the miraculous, before canonization can occur. But there can be too much. Look at the Blessed Chang, beatified 2 centuries ago but never canonized, so far. And why? His order got too eager, that's why. Every time somebody got over a cough, it was a miraculous cure by the Beatus. Visions in the basement, evocations in the belfry, it sounded more like a collection of ghost stories than a list of miraculous incidents. Maybe 2 or 3 incidents were really valid, but when there's that much chaff, well... Father Cherokee looked up. His knuckles had whitened on the edge of the desk, and his face seemed strained. He seemed not to have been listening.
I beg your pardon, Father Abbot?
Well, the same thing could happen here, that's what, said the abbot, and resumed his slow padding to and fro. Last year there was Brother Noyan and his miraculous hangman's noose. Ha! And the year before that, Brother Smirnov gets mysteriously cured of the gout. How? By touching a probable relic of our blessed Leibowitz, the young lout say. And now this Francis, he meets a pilgrim. Wearing what? Wearing for a kilt the very burlap cloth they hooded blessed Leibowitz with before they hanged him. And with what for a belt? A rope. What rope? Ah, the very same. He paused, looking at Cherokee. I can tell by your blank look that you haven't heard this yet. No? All right, so you can't say. No, no, Francis didn't say that. All he said was... Abbot Arcos tried to inject a slightly falsetto quality into his normally gruff voice. All Brother Francis said was, I met a little old man, and I thought he was a pilgrim heading for the abbey because he was going that way, and he was wearing an old burlap sack tied around with a piece of rope, and he made a mark on the rock, and the mark looked like this. Arcos produced a scrap of parchment from the pocket of his fur robe and held it up toward Cherokee's face in the candle glow. Still trying with only slight success to imitate Brother Francis. And I couldn't figure out what it meant, do you know? Cherokee stared at the symbols and shook his head. I wasn't asking you, Arcos gruffed in his normal voice. That's what Francis said. I didn't know either.
You do now?
I do now. Somebody looked it up. That is a Lamed, and that is a Sade, Hebrew letters.
Sade Lamed?
No, right to left, Lamed Sade. An L and a TS sound. If it had vowel marks, it might be lutes, lots, lets, lates, lats, lits, anything like that. If it had some letters between those two, it might sound like, guess who?
Libo, oh no.
Oh, yes. Brother Francis didn't think of it. Somebody else thought of it. Brother Francis didn't think of the burlap hood and the hangman's rope. One of his chums did. So what happens? By tonight, the whole novitiate is buzzing with the sweet little story that Francis met the Beatus himself out there. And the Beatus escorted our boy over to where that stuff was, and told him he'd find his vocation. A perplexed frown crossed Cherokee's face.
Did Brother Francis say that?
No, Arcos roared. Haven't you been listening? Francis said no such things. I wish he had, by gum, then I'd have the rascal. But he tells it sweet and simple, rather stupidly, in fact, and lets the others read in the meanings. I haven't talked to him myself. I sent the rector of the memorabilia to get his story.
I think I'd better talk to Brother Francis, Cherokee murmured.
Do. When you first came in, I was still wondering whether to roast you alive or not. For sending him in, I mean. If you had let him stay out there on the desert, we wouldn't have this fantastic twaddle going around. But, on the other hand, if he'd stayed out there, there's no telling what else he might have dug out of that cellar. I think you did the right thing to send him in.
Cherokee, who had made the decision on no such basis, found silence to be the appropriate policy.
See him, growled the abbot, then send him to me.
It was about 9 on a bright Monday morning when Brother Francis rapped timidly at the door of the abbot's study. A good night's sleep on the hard straw pallet in his old familiar cell, plus a small bite of unfamiliar breakfast, had not perhaps done any wonders for starved tissue, or entirely cleared the Sundays from his brain, but these relative luxuries had at least restored him to sufficient clarity of mind to perceive that he had cause to be afraid. He was, in fact, terrified, so that his first tap at the abbot's door went unheard. Not even Francis could hear it. After several minutes, he mustered the courage to knock again.
"Benedicamus Domino."
"Deo? Gratias?" asked Francis.
"Come in, my boy, come in," called an affable voice, which, after some seconds of puzzling, he recognized with amazement to have been that of his sovereign abbot. "You twist the little knob, my son," said the same friendly voice, after Brother Francis had stood frozen on the spot for some seconds, with his knuckles still in position for knocking.
Yes.
Francis scarcely touched the knob, but it seemed that the accursed door opened anyway. He had hoped that it would be tightly stuck.
"The Lord Abbot sent for me?" squawked the novice.
Abbot Arcos pursed his lips and nodded slowly. Yes, the Lord Abbot sent for you. Do come in and shut the door."
Brother Francis got the door closed and stood shivering in the center of the room. The abbot was toying with some of the wire-whiskered things from the old toolbox.
"Or perhaps it would be more fitting," said Abbot Arcos, "if the Reverend Father Abbot were sent for by you, now that you have been so favored by Providence and have become so famous, eh?"
He smiled soothingly.
"Ha-ha," Brother Francis laughed inquiringly.
"Oh, no, my lord."
"You do not dispute that you have won overnight fame? That Providence selected you to discover this?"
He gestured sweepingly at the relics on the desk.
"This junk box, as its previous owner no doubt rightly called it?"
The novice stammered helplessly, and somehow managed to wind up wearing a grin.
"You are 17 and plainly an idiot, are you not?"
"That is undoubtedly true, my lord abbot."
"What excuse do you propose for believing yourself called to religion?"
"No excuse, Magister Meus."
"Ah, so? Then you feel you have no vocation to the order?"
"Oh, I do," the novice gasped.
"But you propose no excuse?"
"None."
"You little cretin, I'm asking your reason. Since you state none, I take it you are prepared to deny that you met anyone in the desert the other day, that you stumbled on this junk box with no help, and that what I have been hearing from others is only feverish raving?"
"Oh, no, Dom Arcos."
"Oh, no what?"
"I cannot deny what I saw with my own eyes, Reverend Father."
"So you did meet an angel, or was it a saint, or perhaps not yet a saint, and he showed you where to look?"
"I never said he was—"
"And this is your excuse for believing yourself to have a true vocation, is it not? That this, shall we call him a creature, spoke to you of finding a voice, and marked a rock with his initials, and told you it was what you were looking for, and when you looked under it, there this was, eh?"
"Yes, Dom Arcos."
"What is your opinion of your own execrable vanity?"
"My execrable vanity is unpardonable, my lord and teacher."
"To imagine yourself important enough to be unpardonable is an even vaster vanity," roared the sovereign of the abbey.
"My lord, I am indeed a worm."
"Very well, you need only deny the part about the pilgrim. No one else saw such a person, you know. I understand he was supposed to have been headed in this direction, that he even said he might stop here, that he inquired about the Abbey, yes? And where would he have disappeared to if he ever existed? No such person came past here. The brother on duty at that time in the watchtower didn't see him, eh? Are you now ready to admit that you imagined him? If there are not really two marks on that rock where he... then maybe I might... The abbot closed his eyes and sighed wearily. The marks are there, faintly, he admitted. You might have made them yourself.
No, my lord.
Will you admit that you imagined the old creature?
No, my lord.
Very well. Do you know what is going to happen to you now?
Yes, reverend father.
Then prepare to take it. Trembling, the novice gathered up his habit about his waist and bent over the desk. The abbot withdrew a stout hickory ruler from the dresser, tested it on his palm, then gave Francis a smart whack with it across the buttocks.
Deo gratias,
the novice dutifully responded, gasping slightly. Care to change your mind, my boy?
Reverend father, I can't deny...
Whack.
Deo gratias.
Whack.
Deo gratias.
10 times was this simple but painful litany repeated, with Brother Francis yelping his thanks to heaven for each scorching lesson in the virtue of humility, as he was expected to do. The abbot paused after the 10th whack. Brother Francis was on tiptoe and bouncing slightly, tears squeezed from the corners of clenched eyelids.
My dear Brother Francis, said the abbot Arkos, are you quite sure you saw the old man?
Certain,
he squeaked, steeling himself for more. Abbot Arkos glanced clinically at the youth, then walked round his desk and sat down with a grunt. He glowered for a time at the slip of parchment bearing the letters Lamed Sade.
Who do you suppose he could have been?
Abbot Arkos muttered absently. Brother Francis opened his eyes, causing a brief shed of water.
Oh, you've convinced me, boy. Worse luck for you.
Francis said nothing, but prayed silently that the need to convince his sovereign of his veracity would not often arise. In response to an irritable gesture from the abbot, he lowered his tunic.
You may sit down, said the abbot, becoming casual if not genial.
Francis moved toward the indicated chair, lowered himself halfway into it, but then winced and stood up again.
If it's all the same to the Reverend Father Abbot.
All right, then stand. I won't keep you long anyhow. You're to go out and finish your vigil.
He paused, noticing the novice's face brighten a little.
Oh, no you don't, he snapped. You're not going back to the same place. You'll trade hermitages with Brother Alfred, and not go near those ruins again. Furthermore, I command you not to discuss the matter with anyone, except your confessor or with me, although heaven knows the damage is already done. Do you know what you've started?
Brother Francis shook his head.
Yesterday being Sunday, Reverend Father, we weren't required to keep silent, and at recreation I just answered the fellow's questions. I thought,
well, your fellows have cooked up a very cute explanation, dear son. Did you know that it was the blessed Leibowitz himself you met out there?
Francis looked blank for a moment, then shook his head again.
Oh, no, my lord abbot, I'm sure it couldn't have been. The blessed martyr wouldn't do such a thing.
Wouldn't do such a what thing?
Wouldn't chase after somebody and try to hit him with a stick that had a nail in one end.
The abbot wiped his mouth to hide an involuntary smile. He managed to appear thoughtful after a moment.
Oh, I don't know about that now. It was you he was chasing, wasn't it?
Yes, I thought so.
You told your fellow novices about that part, too, yes, eh? Well, you see, they didn't think that would exclude the possibility of his being the Beatus. Now, I doubt if there are very many people that the Beatus would chase with the stick, but...
He broke off, unable to suppress laughter at the expression on the novice's face.
All right, son. But who do you suppose he could have been?
I thought perhaps he was a pilgrim on his way to visit our shrine, Reverend Father.
It isn't a shrine yet, and you're not to call it that. And anyway, he wasn't. Or at least he didn't. And he didn't pass our gates, unless the watch was asleep. And the novice on watch denies being asleep, although he admitted feeling drowsy that day. So what do you suggest?
If the Reverend Father Abbot will forgive me, I've been on watch a few times myself.
And? Well, on a bright day when there's nothing moving but the buzzards, after a few hours, you just start looking up at the buzzards.
Oh, you do, do you? When you're supposed to be watching the trail?
And if you stare at the sky too long, you just kind of blank out, not really asleep, but sort of preoccupied.
So that's what you do when you're on watch, do you?
The abbot growled.
Not necessarily.
I mean, no, Reverend Father, I wouldn't know it if I had, I don't think. A brother I relieved once was like that. He didn't even know it was time for the watch to change. He was just sitting there in the tower and staring up at the sky with his mouth open, in a daze.
Yes, and the first time you go stupefied that way, along will come a heathen war party out of the Utah country, kill a few gardeners, tear up the irrigating system, spoil our crops, and dump stones in the well before we can start defending ourselves.
Why are you looking so... Oh, I forgot. You were Utah-born before you ran away, weren't you? But never mind, you could just possibly be right about the watch. How he could have missed seeing the old man, that is.
You're sure he was just an ordinary old man? Not anything more? Not an angel? Not a Beatus?
The novice's gaze drifted ceilingward in thought, then fell quickly to his ruler's face.
Do angels or saints cast shadows?
Yes. How should I know? He did cast a shadow, didn't he?
Well, it was such a small shadow you could hardly see it.
What?
Because it was almost noon.
Imbecile. I'm not asking you to tell me what he was. I know very well what he was, if you saw him at all.
Abbot Arkos thumped repeatedly on the table for emphasis.
I want to know if you, are sure beyond a doubt that he was just an ordinary old man.
This line of questioning was puzzling to Brother Francis. In his own mind, there was no neat straight line separating the natural from the supernatural order, but rather an indeterminate twilight zone. There were things that were clearly natural, and there were things that were clearly supernatural, but between these extremes was a region of confusion, his own, the preternatural, where things made of mere earth, air, fire, or water tended to behave disturbingly like things. For Brother Francis, this region included whatever he could see but not understand. And Brother Francis was never sure beyond a doubt, as the abbot was asking him to be, that he properly understood much of anything. Thus, by raising the question at all, Abbot Arkos was unwittingly throwing the novice's pilgrim into the twilight region, into the same perspective as the old man's first appearance as a legless black strip that wriggled in the midst of a lake of heat illusion on the trail. Into the same perspective as he had occupied momentarily when the novice's world had contracted until it contained nothing but a hand offering him a particle of food. If some creature more than human chose to disguise itself as human, how was he to penetrate its disguise, or suspect there was one? If such a creature did not wish to be suspected, would it not remember to cast a shadow, leave footprints, eat bread and cheese? Might it not chew spice leaf, spit at a lizard, and remember to imitate the reaction of a mortal who forgot to put on his sandals before stepping on hot ground? Francis was not prepared to estimate the intelligence or ingenuity of hellish or heavenly beings, or to guess the extent of their histrionic abilities, although he assumed such creatures to be either hellishly or divinely clever. The abbot, by raising the question at all, had formulated the nature of Brother Francis's answer, which was to entertain the question itself, although he had not previously done so.
Well, boy?
My lord abbot, you don't suppose he might have been...
I'm asking you not to suppose. I'm asking you to be flatly certain. Was he, or was he not, an ordinary flesh-and-blood person?
The question was frightening. That the question was dignified by coming from the lips of so exalted a person as his sovereign abbot made it even more frightening, though he could plainly see that his ruler stated it merely because he wanted a particular answer. He wanted it rather badly. If he wanted it that badly, the question must be important. If the question was important enough for an abbot, then it was far too important for Brother Francis, who dared not be wrong.
I think he was flesh and blood, Reverend Father, but not exactly ordinary. In some ways, he was rather extraordinary.
What ways? Abbot Arkos asked sharply.
Like how straight he could spit?
and he could read, I think. The abbot closed his eyes and rubbed his temples in apparent exasperation. How easy it would have been flatly to have told the boy that his pilgrim was only an old tramp of some kind, and then to have commanded him not to think otherwise. But by allowing the boy to see that a question was possible, he had rendered such a command ineffective before he uttered it. Insofar as thought could be governed at all, it could only be commanded to follow what reason affirmed anyhow. Commanded otherwise, and it would not obey. Like any wise ruler, Abbot Arkos did not issue orders vainly, when to disobey was possible and to enforce was not possible. It was better to look the other way than to command ineffectually. He had asked a question that he himself could not answer by reason, having never seen the old man, and had thereby lost the right to make the answer mandatory. "Get out," he said at last, without opening his eyes. Chapter 5. Somewhat mystified by the commotion at the abbey, Brother Francis returned to the desert that same day to complete his Lenten vigil in rather wretched solitude. He had expected some excitement about the relics to arise, but the excessive interest which everyone had taken in the old wanderer surprised him. Francis had spoken of the old man simply because of the part he had played, either by accident or by design of providence, in the monks stumbling upon the crypt and its relics. The pilgrim was only a minor ingredient, as far as Francis was concerned, in a mandala design at whose center rested a relic of a saint. But his fellow novices had seemed more interested in the pilgrim than in the relic, and even the abbot had summoned him not to ask about the box, but to ask about the old man. They had asked him 100 questions about the pilgrim, to which he could reply only, "I didn't notice," or, "I wasn't looking right then," or, if he said, "I don't remember." And some of the questions were a little weird. And so he questioned himself. Should I have noticed? Was I stupid not to watch what he did? Wasn't I paying enough attention to what he said? Did I miss something important because I was dazed? He brooded on it in the darkness while the wolves prowled about his new encampment and filled the nights with their howling. He caught himself brooding on it during times of the day that were assigned as proper for the prayers and spiritual exercises of the vocational vigil, and he confessed as much to Prior Cherokee the next time the priest rode his Sunday circuit. "You shouldn't let the romantic imaginations of the others bother you. You have enough trouble with your own," the priest told him, after chiding him for neglecting the exercises and prayers. "They don't think up questions like that on the basis of what might be true. They concoct the questions on the basis of what might be sensational, if it just happened to be true. It's ridiculous. I can tell you that the Reverend Father Abbot has ordered the entire novitiate to drop the subject." After a moment, he unfortunately added, "There really wasn't anything about the old man to suggest the supernatural, was there?" with only the faintest trace of hopeful wonder in his tone. Brother Francis wondered, too. If there had been a suggestion of the supernatural, he had not noticed it. But then, too, judging by the number of questions he had been unable to answer, he had not noticed very much. The profusion of the questions had made him feel that his failure to observe had been, somehow, culpable. He had become grateful to the pilgrim upon discovering the shelter, but he had not interpreted events entirely in terms of his own interests, in accordance with his own longing for some shred of evidence that the dedication of his lifetime to the labors of the monastery was born not so much of his own will as it was of grace empowering the will, but not compelling it, rightly to choose. Perhaps the events had a vaster significance that he had missed during the totality of his self-absorption. "What is your opinion of your own execrable vanity?" "My execrable vanity is like that of the fabled cat who studied ornithology, my lord." His desire to profess his final and perpetual vows, was it not akin to the motive of the cat who became an ornithologist, so that he might glorify his own ornithophagy, esoterically devouring Penthestes atricapilus, but never eating chickadees? For as the cat was called by nature to be an ornithophage, so was Francis called by his own nature hungrily to devour such knowledge as could be taught in those days. And, because there were no schools but the monastic schools, he had donned the habit first of a postulant, later of a novice. But to suspect that God as well as nature had beckoned him to become a professed monk of the order? What else could he do?
There was no returning to his homeland, the Utah. As a small child, he had been sold to a shaman, who would have trained him as his servant and acolyte. Having run away, he could not return, except to meet grisly tribal justice. He had stolen a shaman's property, Francis's own person, and while thievery was an honorable profession among the Utah, getting caught was a capital crime when the thief's victim was the tribal warlock. Nor would he have cared to lapse back into the relatively primitive life of an illiterate shepherd people after his schooling at the Abbey. But what else? The continent was lightly settled. He thought of the wall map in the Abbey's library, and of the sparse distribution of the cross-hatched areas, which were regions, if not of civilization, then of civil order, where some form of lawful sovereignty, transcending the tribal, held sway. The rest of the continent was populated very thinly by the people of the forest and the plain, who were, for the most part, not savages, but simple clansfolk, loosely organized into small communities here and there, who lived by hunting, gathering, and primitive agriculture, whose birth rate was barely high enough, discounting monster births and sports, to sustain the population. The principal industries of the continent, excepting a few seacoast regions, were hunting, farming, fighting, and witchcraft, the last being the most promising industry for any youth with a choice of careers, and having in mind as primary ends maximum wealth and prestige. The schooling which Francis had been given at the Abbey prepared him for nothing which was of practical value in a dark, ignorant, and workaday world, where literacy was non-existent, and a literate youth, therefore, seemed of no worth to a community unless he could also farm, fight, hunt, or show some special talent for intertribal theft, or for the divining of water and workable metal. Even in the scattered domains where a form of civil order existed, the fact of Francis's literacy would help him not at all, if he must lead a life apart from the church. It was true that petty barons sometimes employed a scribe or two, but such cases were rare enough to be negligible, and were as often filled by monks as by monastery-schooled laymen. The only demand for scribes and secretaries was created by the church herself, whose tenuous hierarchic web was stretched across the continent, and occasionally to far distant shores, although the diocesans abroad were virtually autonomous rulers, subject to the Holy See in theory, but seldom in practice, being cut off from New Rome less by schism than by oceans not often crossed, and could be held together only by a communication network. The church had become, quite coincidentally and without meaning to be, the only means whereby news was transmitted from place to place across the continent. If plague came to the northeast, the southwest would soon hear of it, as a coincidental effect of tales told and retold by messengers of the church, coming and going from New Rome. If the nomadic infiltration in the far northwest threatened a Christian diocese, an encyclical letter might soon be read from pulpits far to the south and east, warning of the threat, and extending the apostolic benediction to men of any station, so long as they be skilled at arms, who, having the means to make the journey, may be piously disposed to do so, in order to swear fealty to our beloved son, name, lawful ruler of that place, for such a period of time as may seem necessary for the maintenance of standing armies there, for defense of Christians against the gathering heathen horde, whose ruthless savagery is known to many, and who, to our deepest grief, tortured, murdered, and devoured those priests of God which we ourselves sent to them with the word, that they might enter as lambs into the fold of the Lamb, of whose flock on earth we are the shepherd. For while we have never despaired, nor ceased to pray that these nomadic children of the darkness may be led into the light and enter our realms in peace, for it is not to be thought that peaceful strangers should be repelled from a land so vast and empty. Nay, they should be welcomed who come peacefully, even should they be strangers to the visible church and its divine founder, so long as they hearken to that natural law which is written in the hearts of all men, binding them to Christ in spirit, though they be ignorant of his name. It is nevertheless meet and fitting prudent that Christendom, while praying for peace and the conversion of the heathen, should gird itself for defense in the northwest, where the hordes gather and the incidents of heathen savagery have lately increased, and upon each of you, beloved sons, who can bear arms and shall travel to the northwest to join forces with those who prepare rightfully to defend their lands, homes, and churches, we extend and hereby bestow, as a sign of our special affection, the apostolic benediction. Francis had thought briefly of going to the northwest if he failed to find a vocation to the order, but although he was strong and skillful enough with blade and bow, he was rather short and not very heavy, while, according to rumor, the heathen was 9 feet tall. He could not testify as to the truth of the rumor, but saw no reason to think it false. Besides dying in battle, there was very little that he could think of to do with his lifetime, little that seemed worth the doing, if he could not devote it to the order. His certainty of his vocation had not been broken, but only slightly bent, by the scorching administered to him by the abbot, and by the thought of the cat who became an ornithologist, when called only by nature to become an ornithophage. The thought made him unhappy enough to permit him to be overcome by temptation, so that, on Palm Sunday, with only 6 days of starvation remaining until the end of Lent, Prior Cherokee heard from Francis, or from the shriveled and sun-scorched residuum of Francis, wherein the soul remained somehow insisted, a few brief croaks which constituted what was probably the most succinct confession that Francis ever made, or Cherokee ever heard. "Bless me, Father, I ate a lizard." Prior Cherokee, having for many years been confessor to fasting penitents, found that custom had, with him, as with a fabled gravedigger, given it all a property of easiness, so that he replied with perfect equanimity, and not even a blink. "Was it an abstinence day, and was it artificially prepared?" Holy Week would have been less lonely than the earlier weeks of Lent had the hermits not been, by then, past caring. For some of the Passiontide liturgy was carried outside the abbey walls to touch the penitents at their vigil sites. Twice the Eucharist came forth, and on Maundy Thursday the abbot himself made the rounds, with Cherokee and 13 monks, to perform the mandatum at each hermitage. Abbot Arcos's vestments were concealed under a cowl, and the lion almost managed to seem humble as a kitten as he knelt, and washed and kissed the feet of his fasting subjects with maximum economy of movement and a minimum of flourish and display, while the others chanted the antiphons. Mandatum novum dovobis, ut diligatis in vicem. On Good Friday, a procession of the cross brought out a veiled crucifix, stopping at each hermitage to unveil it gradually before the penitent, lifting the cloth inch by inch for the adoration, while the monks chanted the reproaches. "My people, what have I done to thee? Or in what have I grieved thee? Answer, I exalted thee with virtuous power, and thou hangest me from the gibbet of a cross." And then Holy Saturday. The monks carried them in one at a time, famished and raving. Francis was 30 pounds lighter and several degrees weaker than he had been on Ash Wednesday. When they set him on his feet in his own cell, he staggered, and before he reached the bunk, he fell. The brothers hoisted him into it, bathed him, shaved him, and anointed his blistered skin, while Francis babbled deliriously about something in a burlap loincloth, addressing it at times as an angel and again as a saint, frequently invoking the name of Leibowitz and trying to apologize. His brethren, forbidden by the abbot to speak of the matter, merely exchanged significant glances or nodded mysteriously among themselves. Reports filtered to the abbot. "Bring him here," he grunted at a recorder as soon as he heard that Francis could walk. His tone sent the recorder scurrying. "Do you deny saying these things?" Arcos growled.
"I don't remember saying them, my lord abbot," said the novice, eyeing the abbot's ruler. "I may have been raving."
"Assuming that you were raving, would you say it again now?"
"About the pilgrim being the Beatus? Oh no, Magister Meus."
"Then assert the contrary."
"I don't think the pilgrim was the Beatus."
"Why not just as straightforward he was not?"
"Well, never having seen the blessed Leibowitz personally, I wouldn't—"
"Enough," the abbot ordered. "Too much. That's all I want to see of you and hear of you for a long, long time. Out. But just one thing. Don't expect to profess your vows with the others this year. You won't be permitted.
For Francis, it was like a blow in the stomach with the end of a log. Chapter 6. As topic for conversation, the pilgrim remained forbidden subject matter in the abbey, but with respect to the relics and the fallout shelter, the prohibition was, of necessity, gradually relaxed. Except for their discoverer, who remained under orders not to discuss them, and preferably to think of the matter as little as possible. Still, he could not avoid hearing things now and again, and he knew that in one of the abbey's workshops, monks were at work on the documents, not only his own, but some others that had been found in the ancient desk before the abbot ordered that the shelter be closed. Closed. The news jolted Brother Francis. The shelter scarcely had been touched. Beyond his own adventure, there had been no attempt to penetrate further into the secrets of the shelter, except to open the desk, which he had tried to open, with no success, before he noticed the box. Closed, with no attempt to discover what might lie beyond the inner door marked Hatch 2, nor to investigate sealed environment. Without even removing the stones or the bones. Closed. The investigation abruptly choked off, without apparent cause. Then there began a rumor. Emily had a gold tooth. Emily had a gold tooth. Emily had a gold tooth. It was, in fact, quite true. It was one of those historical trivialities that managed somehow to outlive important facts, which someone should have bothered to remember, but which went unrecorded until some monastic historian was forced to write, "Neither the contents of the memorabilia nor any archaeological source yet uncovered disclose the name of the ruler who occupied the White Palace during the middle and late 60s, although Father Barkas has claimed, not without supporting evidence, that his name was..." And yet, it was clearly recorded in the memorabilia that Emily had worn a gold tooth. It was not surprising that the Lord Abbot commanded that the crypt be sealed forthwith. Remembering how he had lifted the ancient skull and turned it to face the wall, Brother Francis suddenly feared the wrath of heaven. Emily Leibowitz had vanished from the face of the earth at the beginning of the flame deluge, and only after many years would her widower admit that she was dead. It was said that God, in order to test mankind which had become swelled with pride, as in the time of Noah, had commanded the wise men of that age, among them the blessed Leibowitz, to devise great engines of war such as had never before been upon the earth, weapons of such might that they contained the very fires of hell, and that God had suffered these magi to place the weapons in the hands of princes, and to say to each prince, "Only because the enemies have such a thing have we devised this for thee, in order that they may know that thou hast it also, and fear to strike. See to it, my lord, that thou fearest them as much as they shall now fear thee, that none may unleash this dread thing which we have wrought." But the princes, putting the words of their wise men to naught, thought each to himself, "If I but strike quickly enough, and in secret, I shall destroy those others in their sleep, and there will be none to fight back. The earth shall be mine." Such was the folly of princes, and there followed the flame deluge. Within weeks, some said days, it was ended, after the first unleashing of the hellfire. Cities had become puddles of glass, surrounded by vast acreages of broken stone, while nations had vanished from the earth, the lands littered with bodies, both men and cattle, and all manner of beasts, together with the birds of the air and all things that flew, all things that swam in the rivers, crept in the grass, or burrowed in holes. Having sickened and perished, they covered the land, and yet, where the demons of the fallout covered the countryside, the bodies for a time would not decay, except in contact with fertile earth. The great clouds of wrath engulfed the forests and the fields, withering trees and causing the crops to die. There were great deserts where once life was, and in those places on the earth where men still lived, all were sickened by the poisoned air, so that, while some escaped death, none was left untouched, and many died even in those lands where the weapons had not struck, because of the poisoned air. In all parts of the world, men fled from one place to other places, and there was a confusion of tongues. Much wrath was kindled against the princes and the servants of the princes,
and against the Magi who had devised the weapons. Years passed, and yet the earth was not cleansed. So it was clearly recorded in the memorabilia. From the confusion of tongues, the intermingling of the remnants of many nations, from fear, the hate was born. And the hate said, "Let us stone and disembowel and burn the ones who did this thing. Let us make a holocaust of those who wrought this crime, together with their hirelings and their wise men. Burning, let them perish, and all their works, their names, and even their memories. Let us destroy them all, and teach our children that the world is new, that they may know nothing of the deeds that went before. Let us make a great simplification, and then the world shall begin again." So it was that, after the deluge, the fallout, the plagues, the madness, the confusion of tongues, the rage, there began the bloodletting of the simplification, when remnants of mankind had torn other remnants limb from limb, killing rulers, scientists, leaders, technicians, teachers, and whatever persons the leaders of the maddened mobs said deserved death for having helped to make the earth what it had become. Nothing had been so hateful in the sight of these mobs as the man of learning, at first because they had served the princes, but then later because they refused to join in the bloodletting and tried to oppose the mobs, calling the crowds bloodthirsty simpletons. Joyfully, the mobs accepted the name, took up the cry. "Simpletons, yes, yes, I'm a simpleton. Are you a simpleton? We'll build a town and we'll name it Simple Town, because by then all the smart bastards that caused all this, they'll be dead. Simpletons, let's go. This ought to show 'em. Anybody here not a simpleton? Get the bastard if there is." To escape the fury of the simpleton packs, such learned people as still survived fled to any sanctuary that offered itself. When Holy Church received them, she vested them in monks' robes and tried to hide them in such monasteries and convents as had survived and could be reoccupied. For the religious were less despised by the mob, except when they openly defied it and accepted martyrdom. Sometimes such sanctuary was effective, but more often it was not. Monasteries were invaded, records and sacred books were burned, refugees were seized and summarily hanged or burned. The simplification had ceased to have plan or purpose soon after it began, and became an insane frenzy of mass murder and destruction, such as can occur only when the last traces of social order are gone. The madness was transmitted to the children, taught as they were, not merely to forget, but to hate, and surges of mob fury recurred sporadically, even through the fourth generation after the deluge. By then, the fury was directed not against the learned, for there were none, but against the merely literate. Isaac Edward Leibowitz, after a fruitless search for his wife, had fled to the Cistercians, where he remained in hiding during the early post-deluge years. After 6 years, he had gone once more to search for Emily or her grave in the far southwest. There he had become convinced at last of her death, for death was unconditionally triumphant in that place. There in the desert he quietly made a vow. Then he went back to the Cistercians, took their habit, and after more years became a priest. He gathered a few companions about him and made some quiet proposals. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.